You're listening to Yale Radio, WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
This is Dan Cameron. He's with us today on our program. Thank you, Dan, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to begin. You're very welcome. It's good to talk with you. I'd like to begin by asking you a little bit about your history, maybe after Bennington or when you got out of school. Or at an earlier point, what's the first memory for you that got you involved in art and got you on the track of curating?
Well, I was actually already started on the path of curating while I was still an undergraduate at Bennington. They offered these non-resident terms that were 2-month periods, 6 weeks to 2 months, when students would go off campus out into the so-called real world and get themselves some experience in whatever area they might be pursuing. I was a transfer to Bennington, so I only had two of these terms, and both of them were at the Tibor Denaj Gallery on 57th Street. It's actually still on 57th Street. And that experience kind of led me directly into my first curatorial job, which was as the guest curator for the Mint Museum in Charlotte, North Carolina, organizing a retrospective of an artist named Maurice Golubov. And it was clear in my mind by that time, by the time I hit New York in the late summer of 1979, a couple months after graduating from Bennington, it was very clear in my mind that curating was what I was going to do. I just was 100% determined to take that on.
And so what followed? What led up to, say, the new museum? How did that path take you in the curatorial world from this?
Well, that's a 16-year leap right there.
Right.
That you're asking about. What basically happened was I began going around and plugging into all of the spaces and programs in New York City at that time that I thought would be pertinent to what I was interested in. So I was, I was besieging, Artist Space and the New Museum and Franklin Furnace with all kinds of proposals and ideas. I mentioned that I was working for Tibor Denaj Gallery. Well, I wound up organizing a big summer exhibition for them that then went on to Bennington College, and after that went down to the galleries at Virginia Tech. I mean, I would curate, in any space at any time at the drop of a hat for free. At the same time, I was also trying to get my writings published as widely as possible. So that was, really a matter of sending proposals off to Art in America and Art Forum. And actually, I finally got picked up as a monthly contributor to Arts Magazine, now defunct. And that was my first serious, I think, commitment from anybody in the art world that they would pay me on a regular basis just to produce what I was reflecting on. And I think at that time, my relationship to the gallery scene, to the exhibition system as it exists in New York, was very, very, very intense. I mean, I was trying to follow everything all the time, on a constant basis. And that really... You know how the art world is. That means you come up face to face with a lot of people. So, I was meeting people, having conversations, initiating relationships simply by going around to the galleries, which, in the 80s consisted a lot of, the East Village and Soho, as much as it did, going to galleries uptown. So I was really embarked in a very dynamic way. I should also mention that, I didn't really have much of a choice. I was, just kind of, it was sink or swim for me. And the first things I did in New York, because you could still do this in the late 1970s, was procure myself a place that was, a place to live that was secure and cheap, where I had a lease that was never going to be, sort of pulled out from under me. And that was certainly a very significant factor, being able to survive on a specific amount every month enabled me to just kind of be as free as I possibly could. I would have to say that from 1979 to the end of 1983, I had a day job all the time. I was either working at a gallery or I was working somewhere else. I worked for a little while at the Gray Art Gallery as their public relations assistant director. But in 1984, I went off on my own. I made my living from that point on as a freelancer, as an independent. And from then, it was probably a fairly short step to starting to travel and doing an exhibition proposal for the Fundación Caixa de Pensiones in Spain that became an exhibition called El Arte Su Doble, or Art and Its Double. And that exhibition really put me on the map as a curator in Europe and enabled me to work steadily from 1986 on, including a series of exhibitions in Spain that were either international shows or shows of recent American art that were very, very highly regarded at their time, and they drew a lot of attention to themselves. So I would have to say that there was a period of time when I was much more active in the States as a writer and in Europe as a curator. And I think that going to the New Museum, like pursuing that job in 95, was partly the outcome of my feeling that, you know, as much as I loved traveling, it was exciting as, you know, working in international art, or kind of the more global art scene by that time, as exciting as it was for me, I really did want to do things that had a direct relationship to the city I lived in. So I know it's hard for people to believe, but the New Museum, the senior curator job at the New Museum had been available and open for about a year by the time I pursued it. There were no serious takers for the job at that time, and it just seemed like a really great thing to do. So I started the
amazing. What year was that? That was
95. Franz Moran had left the job in I would say spring of 94, and I knew about the job and was thinking about it, but it wasn't until spring of 95 that anyone from the board kind of responded to me or got in touch with me. And then, you know, I just said, wow, I'm gonna go after this as best I can. And at the time, it finally, when it came down to actually giving me the job, it turned out that there were a couple of other sort of suitors. But it was kind of amazing to me that, you know, as recently as the mid-90s, you know, a job like the main curatorial job at the New Museum was still kind of up for grabs. And I think part of that had to do with Marcia Tucker's, her very complicated relationship with the institution, because she was the founder, but she was also getting ready to retire. And it was understood that a curator stepping into that role would have to take on the issue of Marcia's retirement as part of their job. And maybe that was something that was daunting to some people. Marcia had given me one of my very first curatorial jobs. In 1982, she hired me to do an exhibition about gay and lesbian aspects of contemporary art, which is a very brave thing for her to have done. And it certainly got me a lot of exposure for my own curatorial work at a time, you know, like 3 years after I had moved to New York from upstate.
And then from there, from that you were at the New Museum for how long?
At the New Museum, I was there for 11 years. So from 95 to 2006. And I was the senior curator, which meant that I was really in charge of all programs. There was, at that point, only a second position, which is the associate curator. And so those were the two curatorial jobs at the museum for several years. And then at a certain point in the early aughts, there became three curatorial positions. We expanded that to make a senior curator, a curator, and assistant curator. But basically, I did nearly all the exhibitions at the New Museum for an 11-year period.
And following that, you moved on to more independent projects?
Well, it's not as clear cut as that. While I was at the museum, I also stepped up some of my international work. So I was doing different kinds of projects abroad, most notably the Istanbul Biennial in 2003, which was a biennial I had always admired and always yearned to do. And, you know, they called me up literally after 9/11 and invited me to do that show. And I just said, that's the perfect job. You know, so there was a period where I was shuttling back and forth between New York and Istanbul a lot. But that was, I think, a turning point for me, because I realized that as much as I liked institutional work, I also felt that the role of, I wouldn't say independent, but more, a little bit more itinerant curator was more interesting to me. I wasn't as tied to the idea of being part of a bricks and mortar institution. The New Museum had been a very peculiar kind of place in that its surroundings were a little shabby. You know, it was a little bit funky and makeshift, and I think that added a certain atmosphere. The fact that it was not considered, you know, fancy digs by any stretch of the imagination. And I think that was maybe more suitable to my temperament at the time. But yeah, by the time I was leaving the New Museum, which was at the time that the institution was under construction, it was already very clear to me that what I was going to do was start this project in New Orleans, and that I just needed some really invisible time, like about a year of invisible time from mid 2006 to the early part of 2007 to get it all off the ground. And then in 2007, I started U.S. Biennial Inc., which was the first time I've ever gone out and started a company or started my own not-for-profit. And U.S. Biennial Inc. is the company that produces and raises money for and presents Prospect New Orleans.
And so tell me a little bit more about that company. The U.S. Biennial Inc. has produced New Orleans work. Is there other things that it will produce, or what is its mission, essentially?
Well, its mission is to produce the largest art biennial in the United States, and that is in New Orleans. So the premier edition was in 2008. We opened November 1st and drew about 45,000 outsiders and then another about 50,000 New Orleanians all through the city to see, you know, the 80 artists from around the world doing very large-scale projects. So this is the kind of an undertaking that had never happened in the United States before. And the idea is to introduce a completely new form of tourism to New Orleans, which is kind of large-scale international contemporary art tourism, the way it's understood as propelling events like the Venice Biennale or Documenta and the hundreds of thousands of visitors they get. So U.S. Biennial really exists to create this project in New Orleans. The reason it's based in New York is because, in the first couple of years after Katrina, it wasn't really appropriate, or I figured out that it wasn't really appropriate to be trying to raise money for art projects in New Orleans during a time when there were many much more serious ingredients missing to people's quality of life that had to be dealt with first. So that's one of the reasons we based ourselves in New York and raised most of our money outside of the state of Louisiana. But Prospect is my main project right now. I'm the founder, I'm the director, I'm the artistic director. I raise the money, I select the artists, I run the staff. So it's really a very, very big job.
And
I should also mention that I shuttle between New York and New Orleans on a weekly basis. So I have part of my team in one city and part of my team in the other. And I'm also a visual arts director for the Contemporary Arts Center in New Orleans. So I do all the exhibitions there.
So you're at a big commute.
It's a commute. It's fun. I mean, fortunately, there's JetBlue, which makes everything much more comfortable. And the thing is, I've always had this connection to New Orleans, which was really based on the amount of pleasure I got from being there. And it's always been a kind of an interesting antidote or complement to New York. And now it's sort of something that I'm sharing with New York in terms of trying to do something very ambitious.
I think it's interesting to talk about the whole new type of tourism there as well as a link to what I presume is part of the funding pitch for the show. How is the funds raised for this, and are they coming from many disparate sources, or is New Orleans also supporting quite a bit of it because there's such a economic interest in the way you're describing that to New Orleans?
Well, the what's interesting right now is the man who was lieutenant governor of the state of Louisiana is now in 2 weeks becoming the mayor of New Orleans, Mitch Landrieu. And Mitch Landrieu was the only public official in Louisiana that went out on a limb to support Prospect New Orleans with money, to become a sponsor of it. And that's really great for us. The outgoing mayor, Ray Nagin, really, that kind of thing was not really anything that he would particularly get connected with. He's just not, he's not connected to economic development through culture and nor art tourism. But the only problem with Mitch Landrieu going into City Hall is that the city of New Orleans is also pretty strapped. So they don't have a lot of money to invest in much of anything right now. So it's a very challenging moment for that administration, but I think we'll do pretty well. No, most of the money coming for Prospect New Orleans comes from other sources. It's from foundations, our largest single donor or contributor, and then individuals after that. And then finally, I would say corporations and other public sources like foreign governments, who tend to support their artists in international biennials anywhere, but especially in a city like New Orleans, that's a very nice thing to gravitate to. But really, it's the big foundations that support us or that have supported us. And some of that's shifting away from specific arts funding to more kind of social justice-based funding because, of the continuing, lingering questions around New Orleans and its place within our larger culture.
Huh. This kind of brings the conversation around to maybe how much the art world has changed since in just the arc of our conversation. I was talking to David Ross the other day, and it's similar to what you're talking about, even going back a little further, he was really describing how the art world has vastly changed from the 70s to now. And I had heard that one other time when I was speaking to Chuck Close, and he said to me, Brainerd, when I was an artist in New York in the 70s, I could work 2 days a week at a job, and that would pay for my loft, and that was all I had to do. He said, not only that, I could go to every single opening in the city and know every single artist in the city, without extending myself too much. He said, now, of course, that's impossible. So in the span of 30 years, things have changed so much economically, really, and in terms of the numbers of artists and the numbers of galleries and even museums and boards of trustees. And you alluded to a little bit that situation when you were talking about how you got an apartment in New York and it was an affordable space or wherever your space was. It's such a different climate for artists that I wanted to speak to a little bit. How do you perceive the difference in how artists are approaching? Because when I talk to a lot of artists, and certainly students graduating have the issue and the very vexing issue of where do I go first? How do I approach a gallery? It seems a question that's very difficult to answer for many. And in a climate that seems so competitive and so economic, with so much economic pressure, what do you think is happening, and how do you see those changes?
Well, I think we're in a particularly delicate moment right now, simply because you have the combined forces of highly inflationary cost of living in New York, in particular, and the downturn in the economics of, you know, that drives the art market. So artists, I teach it at the School of Visual Arts in a graduate program, so I'm responsible for a group of students that get released as fully grown artists out into the world every May. And it, you know, it's something that comes up a lot, that, you know, the expectations for artists right now have been blunted so much by this kind of explosive growth in the market and the heightened capitalization of the art world. And then, you know, at the same time, they're facing these difficulties in simply knowing where to be based and how to, you know, how to pay for one's practice and how to enter the art world. And I don't think there are easy answers at all. I mean, I know artists that who somehow managed to pull it off. They've figured out some kind of living situation, and they supplement what they make from, you know, doing preparators jobs or doing other kinds of gigs, or something that's a little more specialized, like website design, you know, that just has a better hourly rate and gives them more freedom. And then they are super productive, just immensely disciplined people who, you know, take every spare moment they have and, you know, invest it back into their work. And I am amazed at how many artists I see beating the odds every year and somehow climbing their way out of this sort of undifferentiated morass of sort of talent that's out there and getting someone like me to notice their work, whereby I'm, you know, I'm saying, wow, look at that artist. I didn't know that work before, and let me take a closer look and let me think about this and see if there might be situations in which, you know, we would work together. I mean, my role is a little bit distant from the market because I don't really engage in either the buying or selling of works of art. I'm one of those, you know, actors in the situation whose influence is entirely indirect. But at the same time, it's a very human situation because I can see the struggles that are going on with people just trying to make a go of it. So I would say that, you know, I'm not surprised these days when I do a lecture in Kansas City or Los Angeles, you know, and somebody comes up to me afterwards and says, you know, I'm a young artist. I just got my MFA and I'm moving to New Orleans because, you know, one of the things that New Orleans really has going for it, or two of the things it has going for it, are that there's a spectacular quality of life that you get in terms of being an artistically oriented person. And cost of living is far, far, far below that of New York City or literally any other major metropolitan area in the country. I mean, you can still, there are still $500 apartments in New Orleans and food is very cheap. So there's this idea that, you know, if there's an economic alternative to being part of a large, you know, kind of mega center for the art world like New York is, and, you know, part of what's going to drive those alternatives are the economics, then I think suddenly you're seeing the idea, which was never really considered rational before, that a city like New Orleans could actually turn out to have a sort of a cultural boom as a result of the economy, because so many artists just have said, I can't function with these economic demands in my life right now.
Well, you mentioned that also, that certain artists, you're amazed by how certain artists come up through the ranks and in the difficult situation of New York and the country in general and are exposed to you, or you meet them somehow. Can you say how that happens? How does typically or atypically an artist who you don't know, and let's say who isn't represented by a major gallery, suddenly come on your radar or become of interest to you?
Well, I'm always looking, and I think that's something that every curator has to be able to say, and say honestly. You know, I spend as much time as I have, as I can, going to smaller galleries and alternative spaces, and, you know, looking at shows in places where more emerging artists are the most likely to be, you know, given a chance. So, you know, in New York, we kind of all know what that circuit, you know, is going to be. It's the, sort of the same Lower East Side and Chelsea, in a couple cases, Soho spaces that really focus on, you know, artists who aren't yet established by the market. So I tend to want to see that sort of work anyway, you know, things that are undervalued or underexposed. It's just kind of the way my own nature drifts. I don't think that direct solicitation is all that effective for younger artists. I mean, I certainly know artists that, you know, whose work has come to my attention by them basically, you know, reaching out to me directly and saying, yeah, here's my work, look at it. But it doesn't really play as well as when, you know, I don't know someone's work and I walk into a situation and see it and there it is. And I would also say it's startling to me how often I get to know a young artist through something like, they're on an installation crew, you know, or they're a preparator for something, or they're involved in some other way in the art world, but they're also an artist, you know, or they're working in a program somewhere. And then suddenly I see their art and I put two and two together and I realize, oh, that's somebody I know. And then there's the galaxy out there of former students, you know, people I've studied with, because every year there's at least an artist or two who really does pretty remarkable work. Or I'm traveling around the country and somebody, part of my program is to, you know, visit 10 artist studios in Atlanta or someplace like Seattle. And it's, you know, I have to say there's very often one artist who will just jump out of a situation like that. And their work really calls attention to itself.
That's really helpful and very interesting to hear, Dan. In closing, is there anything you'd like to say to the many artists who are listening to this, largely artists, there's also some students, of course. Any last thoughts to them as they move out into the world of art and pursue their practice?
Well, I would say that what you're doing requires a very delicate combination of idealism and realism. I mean, I think that artists should never forget that they're playing an extremely important role in society, you know, in the culture at large, and that, you know, the rest of us, not just us who are, you know, specializing in other areas of art or culture, but just any of us who are conscious in the world, we're very much in the debt of artists, and that should be acknowledged right up front. That, you know, if you're going to make the commitment to spending your life making art, then you're doing something very, very positive and important for the world at large. And then, you know, but you also have to understand that that contribution is not always recognized as such. And that's something you need to be very aware of starting out. You know, for all of the lip service given to art, the challenges that individual artists make, even when they're faced, even when they're very, very good, are quite daunting. So you have to be able to stick with it, and you also have to have some kind of a plan or an operational framework that's going to allow you to keep putting one foot in front of the other and not get too bowled over by the exigencies of trying to survive as an artist in the 21st century.
Right, so the operational framework is essentially some means of income and a means of living so that you can remain ideal or as much as possible to pursue your artistic practice?
Yeah, and I often tell an artist that it's a good idea to have a five-year plan. That it's a good idea to sort of say, okay, this year I'm going to focus on this, and then once that's behind me, I'm going to start focusing on that. And, you know, that in some cases it's really a matter of knowing how much energy to put into getting your work out there. versus the kind of energy that you need to make the work. Because for many artists, the amount of time and effort in the studio alone with your ideas spent developing something, you know, just seems so counter to what it takes to sort of be a social being in the art world who's, you know, to one extent or another, on the make. You know, you're out there trying to be on your game and hustle up some attention for yourself. And I think that that's a very, I just think that there are conflicts that represent for a lot of younger artists. You know, shouldn't I be in my studio more? Shouldn't I be going to these openings? You know, shouldn't I be, you know, going over and talking to this critic at this open? You know, it's just like, what, you know, how do I do this? And, you know, you have to be true to yourself, but you also have to make sure you don't starve. So, yeah, when I say an operational framework, I guess I mean it in the practical sense, but really also in, you know, in terms of the kind of your headspace and how you're dealing with the day-to-day reality of being an artist.
Thanks so much, Dan. That's really helpful and interesting, and I know a lot of people will be very pleased by this. I want to thank you again for being part of our show today.
Well, it's my pleasure, and thank you very much for including me.
You're listening to Yale Radio, WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.